Welcome to another cloudy episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast in which we discuss real-life aspects of software-defined everything. I'm Ivan Pepelniak, usually found at ibspace.net, and my first co-host today is new to the show, but probably well-known to anyone who watches Networking Field Day recordings, Matt Stone, co-founder and CTO of Stratusplex. How are you doing, Matt?
Doing wonderful. Doing wonderful. It's another hot day in Louisiana, but hopefully we can push through to the fall and the winter.
I wish I would have your weather. It's what you would say around 50s. So it's between 14 and 17 degrees Celsius here and raining.
Yeah, no, we don't. We never see that ever.
Oh, good. By the way, what's this Stratusplex business?
Yeah, so that's kind of my new role. I've just transitioned out of my old role at the city where I was running that service provider network for them. And so right now I'm partnered with an old buddy of mine, and we are doing some cloud initiatives. We're centered around really a kind of a turnkey solution. We have infrastructure as a service where you can kind of consume resources at will, but our sweet spot is geared towards financial services and allowing them to have kind of a turnkey cloud solution where we kind of demystify a lot that the traditional shops would have an issue with, or traditional shops would have maybe potentially some ignorance about how to actually move to the cloud. So we kind of give them a turnkey solution for it.
So you are a system integrator or a service provider, or both?
Service provider. Well, and really kind of both. So personally, my role, I try and stay out of dealing with the end customer, though it doesn't happen all the time. I try and stay back on the back end with the DevOps side of things, so actually managing our infrastructure that we actually deliver the services on top of, and then we have a front-end team that kind of manages the applications with the customer for them. So,
perfect. So you beat me by 2 months or so.
Maybe. I don't know. I think there's probably, I don't think we've branched out into Slovenia yet.
No, I started my company in December and you started yours in October or so.
Ah, yeah, that's true. We're, and really a lot of that time has been kind of getting the infrastructure ready. So we're just now releasing kind of our first, we've got a few clients and we're kind of coming out of beta, so to speak now.
Oh, you know, my life is easier. I'm offering knowledge as a service.
Yes, that's much easier because you have the freedom to tell people like that can't work.
Yes, I have all the fun in the world telling people why things won't work.
Right, which is there's big money in that.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I haven't seen it yet, but I still keep hoping. Oh, speaking of my rants, everyone knows that I'm ranting how it's impossible to build reusable orchestration tools because every single engineer thinks that his network is so special that he needs a unique snowflake design. Matt, I hope you're not like that.
I am not.
Okay. Anyway, our today's guest decided to put a stop to that mentality, and he started not a vendor initiative, but a movement to create a customer-driven cloud reference architecture. Welcome, Rick Parker, Senior Cloud Computing Architect at some very large, well-known multinational company that shall remain anonymous. How are you today?
Good, thanks, yourself.
Pretty good. So, Rick, what are you doing, apart from mentioning your company? I know we'll stay away from that. And how did you get to this idea of starting this initiative?
Well, I've been working in cloud computing since about 2006. I started a public infrastructure as a service company. And I very quickly got involved in cloud computing debates on social media, whether private cloud existed or not. And when the cloud computing terminology started becoming more popular in 2007, 2008, there was a lot of debate around even if private clouds even existed. And I was like, getting involved saying that's kind of silly that they don't exist because I have one. So I was a little confused by people saying that they didn't exist. And I've been fairly heavily involved in cloud computing debate ever since. And about 7-8 months ago, maybe even longer now, it's gone by pretty fast, 8 or 9 months ago, I came to a realization that the best way to prove this was to actually to build one. And I had a pretty comfortable feeling that through people I have worked with in other companies that they would probably be pretty willing to donate software and hardware to actually build this. And through the sponsors of the LA Cloud Engineering Group, we were given data center space. We had some sponsors give us some hardware. So we actually started building what we're working on, which is a hybrid cloud software-defined data center. We really are trying to build a reference architecture for the next generation of enterprise IT and to prove that this actually works. There's a lot of theories out there, and I've been working in a lot of design work, and I was getting a little frustrated not having any hands-on hardware, so that was another outlet to get my hands back on the hardware. But from the very beginning, I started off with the idea of 100% virtualization of everything, even back in 2006. I mean, it's pretty obvious that if you could virtualize servers, that the next step would be to virtualize routers and firewalls and switches and load balancers. So the very first cloud designs that I did were based on the idea that it'd be 100% virtual everything.
So you were doing network function virtualization in 2006, only you didn't know it.
We were just getting there because we did a lot of virtual switches. There weren't a lot of virtual appliances, so the first generation private cloud didn't have a lot of network function virtualization, but the later generations did. So, for example, the last cloud infrastructure I built out used NetScaler virtual appliances.
What were you using for virtual routers?
We weren't getting into the idea behind the design is that we were doing a lot of functional density. That was a design goal. And we were using Juniper SSGs, so we didn't have any. And this is for a production company that did a large-scale internet data extraction. We didn't have any dedicated routers. We were using Juniper SSGs that were router, firewall, VPN devices, integrated devices. So it was a pretty interesting design in that there weren't any dedicated routers. We did not have any.
So effectively, you were using firewalls that were available in VM format, but because that firewall was running Junos, you just got router for free.
Exactly. And you know, I was looking at different devices to build this cloud infrastructure, and I started looking at the spec sheets, and I was really looking for firewalls, and I started looking at the SSG spec sheet, and it said it does OSPF and BGP and routing, and so it had all this routing functionality, and you know, very quickly realized, well, if it does all this routing functionality, why not just take advantage of that? And it ended up working out extremely well because the routing basically configured itself, because as you terminated all the VPNs into the firewall, it basically built the routing by default.
It's funny too, like a lot of the virtual appliances that we're seeing come out right now too are different various front ends for actually just making netlink calls into the Linux kernel. A lot of the data plane aspects are pretty much, for the most part, I don't know specifically how that Juniper box works, but for a lot of virtual appliances that we're seeing around NFV, it's a lot of times just various different ways of interacting with a Linux data plane in reality. And so I think that's kind of humorous that as we start to do this, there's a lot of different ways to solve this problem, but they're typically doing pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, and that's the sad thing, because with a Linux kernel and calls into Linux kernel, you get a few gigabits of throughput and you're wasting the CPU you're running on, because people like SnapSwitch can do tens or hundreds of gigabits through the same Intel server.
Right, and as we start to see the utilization of some of like the FPGA features that Intel's coming out with, I think we'll start seeing open source implementations of that and potentially even integrations at the kernel level. And so hopefully, or at least from my viewpoint, I'm hoping that as kind of time progresses, we'll actually be able to see the open source alternatives utilizing some of that technology as well, because it's not exactly like it's closed off to where nobody can use it. It just that code needs to be written.
Oh, SnapSwitch is open source.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I've never even heard of them.
Oh, you should listen to my podcasts.
I need to get some more time in my day, too.
Anyway, going back to the reference architecture. So, Rick, you're actually building, not just designing a theoretical hybrid cloud, but building one.
Correct. And the idea is to build these different architectures with different vendors. So it'd be a very vendor-agnostic stack. We can plug different vendors into the stack at any time. to test that functionality. And then the idea is to publish the, not only the designs, I'm talking the virtual network designs, the physical network designs, but also the publish the configuration files as well. So what we want is a extremely turnkey reference architecture. So basically anybody can take, I mean, plug this device in port 1 into this device in port 3 is the end goal of the design documents. It's not meant to be perfect. It's just meant to be a very good starting point for people to build their own hybrid cloud. And we've already built the first version. It's been running for 2 or 3 months now. And the hybrid functionality is Amazon's virtual private cloud VPC has configuration information for Juniper as one of them. So you configure the Amazon VPC and generate through Amazon the Juniper firewall code to build the VPN, and then you just copy and paste the Amazon VPC config into the Juniper config, and boom, you have a hybrid cloud. So at times we've already been pinging from the internal private cloud into the Amazon, into our Amazon test instances.
Yeah, Amazon is easy because they are smart and they know that they should interact at layer 3 and use IPsec.
Yes. I'd agree with that.
And then you run BGP on top of that and you're done.
And the other vendors, I expect, are going to be doing the same thing. I don't think the other vendors are too far behind. When I say other vendors, I'm talking Google GCE and HP and Rackspace and everything else. We're also testing OpenStack as well.
That actually raises an interesting question. So, like, are you mainly focused on the hardware, mainly focused on the software? Or are you focusing on both of them? And if you are, like, a lot of this typically would hinge around what hypervisor you're using. And so have you standardized that, or are you trying to appeal to, like, you know, people who run VMware or even Zen Server or KVM? Like, what kind of, as y'all thought through that, what does that look like whenever you actually start putting when the rubber meets the road and you actually start having to build some of that out?
Well, we've actually built out the first version on VMware because we focus on enterprise IT. And this really is kind of private cloud, pretty much is enterprise IT is the goal target customer of this design. And then we will cycle through because this is a 100% test data center. We can tear it down and build it up however we want. And the design goal is to build a software-defined data center. So basically, the hardware will just provide resources, CPU, memory, storage, and all the functionality, routers, firewalls, switches, everything else, will all be virtual. I think we're at the point now where we can build an entire virtual data center within a single physical box. We just plug on a couple of power cables and a couple of network cables, and you'll have a complete set of all the functionality as virtual appliances inside. I think we could do that now.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big fan of kind of the hyperconvergence movement and trying to homogeneize the infrastructure and then allow things be done at the software level. I'm a huge fan of that idea. Obviously, there's some challenges that are presented from like a networking perspective because you're never really going to be able to completely virtualize a switch as far as physical ports are concerned. But with the introduction of things like Cumulus and like some of the toys that are being done with like vSwitch as a hardware platform, there's some really interesting things that are going on there that allow you to manage those kind of homogeneous as well. And so I think as we start going along, this has gotten easier and easier. Like, you started back when it was really hard. So I guess if you're like the hipster of private clouds, then I guess that's accurate because you started back before it was cool. That was back before all the tooling had been built out. But as we've gone, you know, as we've come from 2006 to where we are now, this stuff just gets easier and easier.
Yeah, technically it's not a challenge. It's really a human problem, a human challenge, not a technical problem. Even yesterday, I'm talking yesterday, there was a Twitter post that the Twitter post was, private clouds are bogus. And I replied back saying that public clouds are just private clouds rented out. And his reply was, private clouds on-premise are just on-premise, virtualized on-premise. And I was, there's no correlation between private cloud and where it's physically located. I think the goal of private cloud is to get servers into data centers, real data centers, and get them out of, basically to kill the server rooms.
Right.
Okay, let me just say that this religious argument can only happen in California. While you guys are arguing whether private clouds exist or not, the rest of the world is building them.
Yeah, and I'm building them. I think that's the proof of it. If I can say, you know, here it is, here's the documents, here's the design documents that are tested and proven. Because we also want to test the cost metrics. Because from enterprise IT, management is coming to us now saying, why should we continue doing enterprise IT if we can just go to public cloud services? So I think enterprise IT is now under pressure to prove that we are more reliable and more cost effective in public cloud services. So we want to provide not only the technical reasons, but the business reasons for this private cloud implementations that we can meet or beat public cloud prices.
And I think too, like it's so like I run a quote unquote public cloud. So, I mean, what you're saying should scare me, but it doesn't, because I think there's like a threshold, right? Like there are certain size businesses that there's a threshold you cross where it makes sense to do a private cloud. And then there's a threshold that's below that where it makes sense to do a public cloud, because there's a certain size organization. For instance, financial institutions are a good example, which is what our target customer is, that have to do things like business continuity and disaster recovery, that they might be small enough to where that's actually cost them way more to do than they would do in the cloud, than they could do in like a public cloud, for instance. And that's really our sweet spot. Now, I think, and you might agree with this, I don't know, but from what I see is as we go forward with this, I think there has to be a hybrid of public cloud and private cloud consumption. And I think marrying those two together in a really kind of seamless way is going to be where cloud providers are made or broken.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. I don't think it's public versus private. I think it's hybrid above all. You know, and hybrid could be 80% private and 20% public, or 80% public and 20% private, depending right. on the state of the company. And I think there's probably a couple of different levels or thresholds where compute requirements of a certain size are more towards public. And then as you get a little bit or some size bigger, they might go back to private. When they get bigger, it might go back to public. So there's, but I think there's also an idea of a federated cloud where I wouldn't want to depend on just Amazon or any public cloud provider. I would see the hybrid cloud, kind of the private component of the hybrid cloud, as the control center, kind of the architecture brokerage. And from this private cloud systems, you could manage your public cloud connections and, you know, your public cloud consumption across multiple public cloud providers.
Now, when you think about that kind of nirvana, because that sounds really good, but that's like when you talk about that kind of solution, like there's two different aspects from that. That's relatively easy to accomplish whenever you have the kind of cattle mentality of your application, where your application's workload is spread across X number of servers, etc. The reality for most SMBs, which is what we target, is that they have one server that does X, this other server does Y, this other server does Z. And so having something like that where you're replicating that disk to, you know, cloud provider A and then moving it to cloud provider B, like that could pose a really big problem if it's the same machine having to get migrated between two different places. And you understand, I'm sure, all of the different weirdness that can go on between different processor classes and stuff like that. And so how do you see that going forward? Are you saying that most people now need to adopt kind of the scale out style web 2.0, whatever buzzword else I can throw in there? Are you suggesting that now people have to be more agile and have those type of applications adopted? Or is this something that you see can be adopted by the kind of pet mentality of the server, where I have this one server that runs X, Y, and Z?
I know enterprise IT is about the complete opposite of Facebook and the others. You know, when generally people refer to cloud, they refer to Facebook and Salesforce, etc. And to your point exactly, those are one application times 1,000 servers. And on the other end of the spectrum, I'm going to, use an extreme example here. It's like 1,000 applications times one server each. Yeah, I was being a little sarcastic there on the scale, but really, most enterprises support hundreds of applications. But the idea with a federated cloud is you could put some applications on one cloud and some applications on another cloud. You may not get that scale out effect, but if you lose a public cloud provider, a single public cloud provider, we're not going to lose all our applications at once.
Right. We might lose a subset of them, but we haven't lost all of them.
Correct. cracked.
Now, Rick, for me, when we talk about the hybrid cloud, the big question is, first, how do you ensure that data is consistent on all locations? And the second one is, if you decide that this data center is down and you have to restart the workload in a public cloud, for example, how do you orchestrate the whole thing?
And that's an interesting problem, too, because networking typically gets a bad rap from that respect. That's relatively easy to solve from a network perspective. Storage, for me, and what we've built out internally, storage has, from day one, been the biggest burden on how do we solve like things like replication and backup and then disparate workloads that need different like types of IOPS. Like, those aren't easy problems to solve. So I'm interested to hear kind of your take on that.
Kind of goes into monitoring a lot. I monitor extensively, probably more than anybody I've ever run into. So kind of to your point of IOPS and requirements, but you have to monitor all of these things to verify or not verify you can increase your resources before you hit any performance thresholds. So, and to the point of monitoring, I monitor every single port, every single switch, every single service. It's a good rule of thumb is about 15 monitors per server. So for 500 servers, you should have something on the order of about 7,500 monitors. And that's kind of how you keep things running well. It becomes very operational. When we get into hybrid cloud management, you spend most of your time in your monitoring systems because those kind of tell you what needs to be done. It becomes monitoring by report as opposed to monitoring by alert. But going back to...
I would echo that too, because that's one of the biggest things we do as well, is like, you know, not only just collecting that data, but having good ways of being able to parse that data. And so, like, it's like, I know people who collect tons of data but do nothing with it, and that's just as bad as not collecting it. And so, yeah, I would echo that sentiment and also say you have to be, like you said, operationally, you have to be in those things all the time, making sure that capacity is effectively partitioned where it needs to be.
When it comes into hybrid cloud design, you have to start at the very highest level of the design. So it's, how big should your data centers be and where should they be? So going to your point of like latency and how do you manage data consistency is the idea of having data center clusters, because basically all I hear is, well, you can't put one data center on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, because the latency is too big. Well, the simple answer to that is you put them about 100 yards apart from each other, and then your latency goes down to nothing. So, for example, the second cloud I built, the second data center really was only about a quarter mile from the first data center. Again, you know, kind of pretty lucky the way it turned out is the area I'm in has a lot of data centers. But the thing is, a lot of the data center design is how big should data center be and where should they be. The legacy designs is, it was based on the fact that there weren't very many data centers. It was based on the fact that data center bandwidth was very, very expensive. But those two facts are no longer true and haven't been true for a long time. So now you can do things like, you know, put two data centers on the West Coast, two data centers on the East Coast, and two data centers on the middle of the country, and create these data center clusters. And you could do LUN replication between your data center clusters, and you have multiple databases. So going back to enterprise IT, if you have, you know, 100 applications, you may have 100 databases striped across all these data centers. This idea of having six data centers to start.
Your bandwidth perspective, like, our data center partner for what we do is Equinox. And so our two main sites are Dallas and Atlanta, right? So there's multiple data centers in those locations, like multiple actual physical buildings. And Equinox from our, and this is one of the reasons we chose them, is they'll actually provide you bandwidth between both locations for the cost of a cross connect. Or in some cases, if you're a customer and you own both ends of the racks, they'll do it at no cost. And so there's, from that perspective, you can get sort of that block level and block level kind of replication at, you know, millisecond level. You can get that between two data centers that are in the same city, for instance, but you're not going to do that between, for instance, Dallas and Atlanta. You're going to have terrible results if you try and do that. But But yeah, so to your point, I really like that saying, okay, like from the replication perspective, that does alleviate like a lot of risk doing it between those two, even those two buildings. That block level instant, kind of, you don't get a write complete back from your storage, device, until it's written in two places. That makes total sense between, for instance, two different data centers in the same city. But then you do sort of your nightlies that are, backed up every night where you replicate off site where it's not really latency contingent.
Or you can do asynchronous replication, or you can do database log shipping, right, or whatever you like to do.
Yeah. And there's tons of stuff on the application level that can alleviate a lot of that risk too.
So I had this idea of a redundant array of inexpensive data centers, you know, this cattle versus pet theory at the data center level. And that's when I read into Ivan on his data center interconnect design webinar. Probably about a year and a half ago, you know, it was like nirvana to me, finding somebody else who was looking at doing the same thing. So I was pretty excited to find Ivan's webinar. And one of the ideas with this cloud group is to build out Ivan's design for the data center interconnect.
Oh, so if it doesn't work, it's my fault then. Ouch.
No. Hey, you said you're the one that said you were selling knowledge as a service, remember?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Now, the one thing I still can't grasp that I'm really struggling with is, okay, we have the data across. If we want to restart the whole application stack on the other end, we need the services, which is okay because they're virtualized. We need the networking infrastructure, we need the VLANs, we need the port groups or whatever they are called. We need to connect the VMs to the right port groups. How do you orchestrate that across multiple private clouds first, and then how do you move that to one or more public clouds?
We have to look at the orchestration software. One of them that I really like is Embotics, Embotics. Has either one of you ever heard of Embotics?
I haven't.
Nobody, very few people I've ever heard of has heard of them. But they're extremely good, and Embotics has been around for a long time. It's been around for 5 or 6 years now, 4 or 5 at least. And I think they're on version 4 or 5. I highly recommend checking it out. It is cloud management application only. You know, it's not like VMware, vCloud Automation Center, where there's kind of, you know, it does very well for VMware, but not as good as for other public or private clouds. So Embotics supports like Hyper-V and Xen and VMware, and it has Amazon support as well to provision and spin up. There's this idea of, you know, private cloud doesn't work because you can't use it for burst capacity. It really is kind of a myth. But if you pre-stage your templates in the other data centers, then it doesn't take up much room, and you can use something like Embotics or one of the other cloud management apps to manage the spin-up of the application servers in the other locations. And we're also looking through the cloud engineering group to do a lot of orchestration through Puppet or Chef. We already have a Puppet and an Ansible management system set up, and we're looking at spinning up Chef next. So we're looking at not only the technical configurations, but also how are we going to manage this as well. So we're going to be spinning up different cloud management apps to test as well.
So Embotics, if I understood you correctly, solves the problem of spinning up VMs in different places. But correct, you still have to have the, let's say, networking infrastructure pre-configured.
Correct.
And you guys are now trying to solve that problem that I guess not many people have even tackled, of automating the provisioning part of the networking, well, virtual networking infrastructure.
That's true, and that's something we're going to be working on. Part of your data center interconnect design addressed some of that. In other words, when a public IP's failed at one data center, how could you reroute those public IPs to go through the other data center, maybe back through the data center it connect to? So, for example, if the routers, the external routers died on data center one, those IPs would be rerouted through data center two, but the traffic could also be routed through a data center interconnect from data center two back to basically through a data plane to data center one.
Well, I would hope that you will use DNS for that, not reroute IP addresses, but okay.
The terminology was being very generic there.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Good. Good. Then we're in sync.
With, like, at the application level, having to reconfigure like NATs and stuff like that. And so like when you look at the I agree with you, Ivan, it would be really awesome if we could solve that at the DNS level, but there's some things with the kind of pet mentality of servers that, especially at the level that we're talking about with enterprise, that you can't solve without some sort of moving of the IP addresses. And that wouldn't be that big of a deal. The biggest issue with that right now is the lack of IPv4 addresses that we have access to. That's honestly the biggest Achilles heel of that right now moving forward is the fact that we, like, for instance, ideally you would have a block of addresses you announce from each data center, ideally. But we're entering into an era where that's probably not going to be something you can do, at least on the V4 level.
So you're saying that effectively we cannot use the correct design to solve this problem anymore because you can't get more than 1/24.
The problem becomes harder to solve. You might have to have an extra layer of abstraction. For instance, like you announce your /24 from another data center or another two data centers that then have private connections back to your cluster of data centers in the back. I mean, you could do something like that, but that adds another level and another cost to your kind of the entire piece of the puzzle. And so, yeah, I mean, ultimately, if everybody was on V6, thumbs up, we could solve it that way. That would be real easy. But from a V4 perspective, you don't have the freedom to just say, like, well, I've got 8 data centers. I want 8/24s anymore. Aaron's going to be like, yeah, good luck. We'll see you.
Have you ever tried, now that we open this can of worms, announcing more specific prefixes to service providers with no export?
You're talking about, like, I have a single /24 and I'll announce like a /28 from, you know, a few different data centers.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a viable option, but then you're kind of relegated to that specific, service provider, which if they're large enough isn't a huge deal, but it is what it is.
Yeah. You have to have the same set of service providers in all locations. Otherwise you're stuck. Right. Interesting times.
And again, I think some of these issues are, as newer technologies are coming to the forefront, things like NSX and stuff like that, and really kind of the foundation of what NSX is, which is VXLAN, things like that help with that automatic provisioning, because then you have a homogeneously configured physical network, and then you can migrate like VXLAN tags from one place to another. Now, obviously, you have to migrate the entire workload, like the entire layer 2 subnet, but if you're shutting down an entire data center, and booting that up in a different location, that's not a huge deal. You can move that one VXLAN tag. As long as you are very precise about how you number that and make sure you have unique ones everywhere, you can conceivably just migrate it to another location. The same with VLANs, just on a smaller scale.
One of the ideas with this redundant array of inexpensive data centers isn't so much about spinning up a replacement data center in another location. Kind of the idea is starting off with 6 data centers. If you lose one of your data centers, you're only going to lose, you know, some of your capacity. You're not going to lose your availability. And the amount of the size of your data center should allow for you to lose an entire data center. And you'd almost want to do that. And the design is to be able to do that for maintenance. So we would want to be able to design to the scale of shutting down an entire data center during the day for maintenance, not only for maintenance, but for upgrades. Because a lot of the downtime costs that I experienced in enterprise IT was for maintenance. And if you can, the maintenance actually caused, you know, downtime. But if you build the maintenance resource capacity into your design, that's something I just kind of thought of as calling it maintenance capacity. And it's something that's kind of required and not given a lot of thought to. But what we're shooting for is 100% infinite availability, not 5 nines or 4 nines, infinite 100% availability. And it's a pretty big design goal. But if you build maintenance capacity into your data center design, it's a possibility.
Now, this is a great idea, and it would work extremely well with properly designed applications. Unfortunately, with the traditional enterprise applications, I see a number of hurdles. For example, if you want to shut down a data center in the middle of the day, with properly designed applications, you would just spin up extra copies of the servers on the other end and shut down the servers on this end, and everything would work. With enterprise one application per server model, you would have to migrate the VMs over there.
Which is a capacity nightmare. Now, if you have like local data centers that have 40, 100 gigs of capacity, you could conceivably do that. However, most people aren't going to have that. And even so, that's a tremendous amount of data to try and copy from one place to another. So the alternative is, in your maintenance window, you shut those devices down, and then a cleaner way is shut those devices down and then boot them up in a different location. And that issue has a lot of the things you were just talking about, where how do you migrate the networking stack? Like, for instance, even if it is internal IP addresses that are, you know, if these arrays are linked via like IPsec tunnels or something, even if it is an internal /24, how do you migrate the announcement of that to a different place? How do you migrate, if it utilizes VLANs, how do you migrate those VLANs and make sure that they're unique? How do you migrate the VXLAN tag if it is VXLAN? And I think a lot of those things can be orchestrated now with network function virtualizations, where the router is actually virtual, et cetera. But
yeah.
To your point, I don't know that we can achieve that 100% uptime guarantee from the traditional applications, for the main reason being there's too much vulnerability at the application level.
We can blame that on the developers, though.
We could blame a hell of a lot on the developers, that's for sure.
Okay, so on this sad note, let's wrap it up for today. So, Rick, if people want to join your effort or just be there and play with the boxes or test their ideas, how can they find you? How can they find your meetup? Do I have to be in LA or can I join remotely? What are the rules?
No, we can join remotely. We already have members all over the country and probably in different countries as well. So I'll have to get you the URL on Meetup, but if you search Meetup, I think, for LA Cloud Engineering Group, it should pop up somewhere, but I'll have to get you the exact URL. And all members of the group have full admin access to all systems or whatever systems they want access to, from the storage systems to the routers to the cloud management systems. Because one thing is, we do want to kind of break down these technical silos.
And where can people find you if they want to get in touch with you? Are you on Twitter? Are you blogging?
I'm on Twitter at Parker Cloud, a member of the infamous Clouderati group.
And you blogging?
A little bit. I don't have a lot of current, but I'm got a blog at Fluid Computing. Again, I'll have to get you the exact URL for that. That goes into this data center modular, data center cluster articles. I have a few of those written there, but I'll have to get you the exact URL.
And I'll include all the URLs in the show notes so that the listeners can just go to the show notes and find them and start exploring.
Perfect.
Thanks for being with us today. It's been a really interesting discussion. And as you progress with this project, I hope you'll come back and tell us more.
Yeah, I will enjoy that. Thank you.
And Matt, where can people find you? You still blogging?
Rarely. And when I do, it's probably going to be not too deep. But yeah, I've still got my blog at bighamstone.com. And I'm still on Twitter at bighamstone. That's how you can find me, to yell at me or whatever.
And you're busy building clouds, I guess.
Yeah, or something. It's going to be something by the time we're done.
Perfect. And I'm Ivan Pipelniak, and I'm blogging about clouds, not building them, at ipspace.net, and rarely tweeting as at iOSHints. If you're interested in SDN or cloud networking, then you'll find more resources at ipspace.net/SDN and ipspace.net/cloud. And looking at all those webinars, you just might find out that you can't decide which one is best for you, in which case, just go for the webinar subscription. And finally, if you like the show, please tell a friend, leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to follow us at podcast.ipspace.net.